Improving Society in less than 30 minutes. The short podcast of Körber Stiftung. How does the competition for technological leadership affect the global balance of power? How should cyberspace and new technologies be regulated? And by whom? Two of many quintessential questions which were discussed at the 175th Bergedorf Roundtable on the geopolitics of digital transformation. The Bergedorf what? Our Bergedorf Roundtables provide foreign policy decision makers with a forum for a frank exchange of views. Here, they are able to develop new ideas and policy alternatives in an informal atmosphere. But since these questions concern us all, we wanted to share some of what we've discussed. So let's open the debate to a larger audience and explore what digital transformation, international power rivalries, and national security have to do with each other. I am excited that Nandjira Sambuli, one of the keynote speakers of the conference, will share her insights with us today. Next to being a board member at the Digital Impact Alliance, president of the Transform Health Coalition, and advisor to Carnegie Council's AI and Equality Initiative, Nandjira was also named one of the BBC's 100 Inspiring and Influential Women. Now let's show you why. Welcome to the show, Nandjira Sambuli. Moin, so hello.
Hello. It's lovely to be here.
We're happy to have you on the show. You always look at the impact that society has on technology and obviously the other way around. That seems to be like a very broad field. Can you give us a bit of a context? What exactly is it that you're interested in, or what other questions that you ask? What are you looking into?
Sure. It's quite important to have that broad view because typically, especially with technology, you can very easily get caught up in thinking about it as just a very one-way, one-sided thing. But looking at how that cycle sort of replicates itself and, you know, technology impacting society, society impacting technology calls for, you know, looking at it in terms of something like human rights or how politics are shaping or how power dynamics are shifting or how economic development or social development, all these aspects that should give us a whole rounded view of how these two things are working in lockstep is quite important. So it's quite broad strokes, but very fun because then one, there's never a dull day. And two, you can really bring different knowledge aspects into really shaping and giving more nuance to the conversations we have about the two.
If we think about important opportunities and risks in regards to AI, which is one of the trending topics at the moment. Everybody looks into innovation and what it could do to us. With regard to the economic development, national security and social cohesion, what are those important risks and opportunities of AI we have to look at?
I like to talk about them in lockstep. You know, typically most conversations will say opportunities and maybe have risks as an afterthought, or risks and then, you know, not looking at the opportunities enough. And I think in that regard, what we have to look as a useful starting step is who's designing, who's shaping one, societies alone. I mean, who makes decisions, whose views are incorporated into policies and plans. And in the same way, who gets access to the resources that help them develop the AI tools that then we get to start to use across societies. So those two things are very important to look at. Now, there are very interesting opportunities that have been presented by tools like AI, for instance, in an ideal world. They can help make, you know, whether it's just business processes more efficient, and that way, you know, you can release human capital to do more creative work, for example. That would be an ideal situation. But at the same time, the way we live in a very imperfect world, it means that the way AI is being introduced, even in, say, business processes or how it's talked about, it shows us that there's also immediate risk of displacing people who already have a certain sense of work or job security. And so pairing those two to make sure that we understand what we're talking about in different contexts is very important, so that we're not always just overhyping, whether it's the opportunities or overemphasizing the risks, without bringing that nuance. So at this point, we're still waiting to see, really, as these technologies are being unfolded, and especially AI itself, the hype from the reality, right? But really trying to make sure that in the conversations and in the deployment, these are elements that are being held in regard together, so that we make sure we're able to explain the decisions that this AI is able to do and account for every step of the way, what decision was made, whose voices were included, but more importantly, whose voice or perspectives were excluded, because it's very important to keep check on that.
In regard to the individual, people very often tend to think that AI is for scientists or the politicians have to regulate it, but it is already in our everyday lives. For example, there's this huge debate on whether you should have a smart device at home that is constantly listening to what you say. So this would be an impact on the individual, like, or on the family, and there are kids around. And some people hesitate and say, well, I see the benefits, you know, if I ask that device to play my favorite music and I don't have to do anything else, like no touching of any buttons or anything, that's helpful. But on the other hand, I don't want them to listen to what I say to my partner. Is that something that people just, you know, they take the risk, or is that something we should regulate more, we should look into more, we should do more of, you know, give knowledge what is really happening, or regulate the companies that are, you know, creating those devices?
In that particular instance, we're talking in a sense about individual consumer choice, where individual could be a household or one person. I think the challenge is whether people fully understand the implications of doing so, having a listening device or a smart device in the homestead, whether they have given informed, meaningful consent to the terms and conditions of how when they purchase the exciting new gadget. Mm. You know, I think there's been conversations about at what point is it a one-off consent issue? If there's an update, for example, and it changes the terms and it's in some legal language, do people really understand? But a lot of this is marketed as consumer choice, and it really just shows more of the benefits and does not give you insights into the harms. But one way to think about whether this is necessarily all good and convenient is to think about, for example, the emerging understanding that these tools, for example, can be used to perpetrate gender-based violence, for example, because it can be a useful device for somebody to listen in on you. And we've seen cases, there's a great New York Times article that talked about how partners have been sort of like surveilling their partners by controlling those devices and, you know, having remote listening. But even the companies themselves are using that to collect data. So when they use terms and conditions like we'll use collect data for improvement purposes, what do they mean? Are you actually aware, and is that what you're consenting to? There's a lot more awareness that does have to be raised at that level, but it's also tied to the point about regulating. And, you know, whether how do we strengthen the notion that you should make sure individuals are fully aware of what, for example, data is being collected, what that device is actually doing, and making sure that that is explainable in language that makes sure that the individual who has purchased this device understands it. And every time you make a change, that you're able to show that you updated them and they fully understood before they ticked in. The other challenge we have is we have all these all or nothing terms and conditions. It's like you agree to everything and not nothing, you can't opt out. Mm-hmm. So these are the challenges around how where conversations about regulation come in, whether it's the companies regulating themselves in that regard, or whether we need governments to step in and regulate your home device, which is a whole other
topic. Yeah, you were talking about consumer choice, and I wonder, I think if I'm correct, then once you enter another household, you must be informed that there is such a device in the house,
right?
Because you haven't given your consent for this particular tool when you enter a new household. But then on the other hand, on everyday life, you know, I would never ask my friends whether they have such a tool or not. So there is something in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's going to change how we relate. And this is, again, technology impacting society, impacting technology. Mm. Are we going into a future now when I come onto a call with Dan like this, I ask her, so how many other devices are recording our conversation here? What about off the record remarks? Yeah. I wouldn't be able to know how many gadgets you have around you. So I can imagine when you visit in a more physical and intimate setting, those might become the ways, you know, as you say hello at the door, you start asking, so how many gadgets here are recording me? How many CCTV cameras, how many recording devices in the name of speakerphones or smart devices do you have in your house? How much data about me is about to be inadvertently collected? And especially if I've been doing a good job of staying off the grid, if you will, it's going to change the way we actually have relations, which is an important thing to keep in mind. And I think we need more conversations on that sort of day-to-day level about whether these are the terms we want with the technologies that are shaping our lives so intimately. Mm-hmm.
All of this, however, seems to be so small when it comes to using AI with lethal autonomous weapons. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, weapons, it's an entirely different thing. And we all have this horror scenario of AI taking over the world, you know, robotics killing all humankind and all of these things. I wonder which regulations must be put in place to ensure the ethical standards in the development and use of those technologies. And how or by whom should these regulations be enforced?
Important that we're having these conversations even before these technologies become mainstay. And I think part of the challenge in who should regulate and who shouldn't is how we frame the question can either include or exclude the wrong perspectives. Because in today's world where developers and creators can be self-taught or they can go through industry or government research facilities and so on and so forth, you have to find the stream of everybody who's in a position to create. You and I might be able to have other sets of tools that we put together and are able to have that potential, for example. So in a way, it's like saying everybody should be involved in these conversations. And if that's the case, then we're going back to the idea of the body politic around how societies give, to shape the rules and deliberate around the rules of engagement and the guardrails that shape their societies. So in that regard, this is a conversation that should not be seen as just one for technical experts or politicians, but for societies at large, because who's creating again? Who has, why are they creating that tool? Did they create it for that purpose, or is that just an intended side effect? These are very important sort of roadmaps along the way that inform that entire conversation. But all too often, we either get to a very doomsday-like scenario and assume that these are technical conversations for very specialized actors when we all could be impacted by how any technology is used for good or for harm. So I think for me, with laws, which is the lethal autonomous weapons systems, on one hand, it's important, obviously, to have a conversation about it, but also remember that this is so intricately linked to what kinds of societies do we want to shape, and especially in a globalized world, who gets to shape the rules of engagement, and why would anyone be motivated to develop a tool like that? What other processes did not serve the purpose to air their grievances or, assert their power, if you will, that are also just as important around, as the technical standards around what we develop and what we do not. Mm-hmm.
That leads me to the Digital Impact Alliance, or short DIAL, where you're a board member. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit more about that and about the inequalities between advanced and less advanced developed economies. Mm-hmm. Where's the specific angle here? What is so important that we're missing out when it comes to technology and these inequalities?
Well, at DIAL, one thing that has been developed pretty well is the principles for digital development. And it's a set of 9 principles that really the idea is to guide everybody who's doing any form of digital development to adhere to, sort of voluntarily say that they'll approach their technological development with. Now, they sound really simple when you read them. User-centered design, for example, or design with people, not without, you know. But the real challenge is always in practice and how you account for how you did that. You just do a tick box measure and you get 5 people and say they're representative of a whole society, for example. You know, it's now about how do you effect these kinds of principles into effect. Because it also makes it a long, drawn-out process to most people. But it's perhaps very necessary if any technology is going to impact a particular community, whether it's a very small community or the global community, if you will. So it really just is a sort of set of aligning principles that have actors from government to civil society to business sector adhering to. And the real interesting work is making sure that they can account for how they practice what they preach over and above signing to them. And these are the important things, especially around power holders in creating and deploying of tech, that is very important to keep in mind, to a point you made earlier about how innovation is just often so hyped, like let's do it and we'll figure it out when we get there. But you know, we are trying to make sure that you move beyond this whole notion of move fast, break things, because when you're breaking things, you're breaking societies. How do you square the circle around that is kind of some of the work that DIAL and through the principles does, but also with this specialized work around helping governments with figuring out the best way to procure technologies, how to make sure that they are contextualized for a particular community and society, and they are sustainable. You know, you don't want to keep buying any new wave of technology. Today we're talking about AI. Tomorrow we have blockchain and Internet of Things, and then we have to start from scratch. How do you make sure you build elements of interoperability and adaptability and resilience to the systems that are deployed to work and serve societies?
Doesn't that really hold true for every society?
Yeah,
I mean, even though many people might have access to tools or to knowledge, I would say even here in Germany or in Europe, I'm saying even, but I'm aware of that other countries and societies have gone way further down the line when it comes to technology and AI. We do have access to courses, to knowledge, but the individual and then maybe the society as a whole sometimes doesn't really care or isn't informed enough. So isn't it maybe a matter of giving importance to these topics rather than just looking at the access to it? Or is it kind of both?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, part of it even goes as far back as how do we educate, and not just informal education, but how do we learn skills, any kinds of skills to just make us live in cohesive societies? Technology is necessary, broadly, a conversation and a topic that should be in there. So I think, for example, in this instance, the Finnish AI modules, which are open and available to anyone to go through, and they're designed for any individual who's not a techie, if you will, or tech savvy, to just understand what AI is, what it does, and so on and so forth. And that's great that those are available, and I think can be universally applicable in a way. But it does not mean that, you know, build it and they will come. And this is very true about everything, about every technology or any awareness program, build it and they will come. So it's always very important to link the notion of technology with society and understand when do societies come together to, you know, discuss what topics of interest, how do you make sure these things are brought to the people, not just build, you know, something over there and hope that they will come to it. That's one area to start squaring the circle around. We can make things available does not mean necessarily that they're accessible. So understanding societies becomes very important in that regard, because then you'll know maybe some people prefer to have these conversations in WhatsApp groups. Maybe it's one person who's an influential node in their community or an organization or a group that will be able to sensitize and bring these conversations into a particular society's discourse and knowledge shaping, if you will. So there's still that figuring out how we make it all happen. I think it works very well in Finland because the communities there are perhaps interested, and I know that many, it helps. But it's not necessarily going to be the same in a bigger country like Brazil or the US or in the entire European Union. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done around how we embed narratives about technology into everyday societal discussions, how media covers these things, how interest groups like civil society groups make sure that they actually bring these conversations to people where they are, not just building things and hoping that they will come. So this is the work that we all have to figure out. And there's many parts, many moving parts. One does not trump the other. The question is really, how can we make sure that they're all working in lockstep?
Yeah, you just make such a fair point. I mean, we always talk about the government, the politicians, and maybe somehow the individual that is responsible for this movement. But then there's media coverage, there's education. There are so many factors within this. So how can we make sure we're all on the same line? How can we make sure we all join the movement and go forward together? We're not leaving anyone behind.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, we have that as a mantra with the global goals, leave no one behind.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's always like where the rubber meets the road is the most interesting point of departure. I think how we usually have thought about societies being organized in sectors, government or public sector, private sector, civil society, and so on and so forth, are all important, but they're not silos. They have to find ways to interoperate. And that's been a tricky thing, because then that takes us back into the realm of politics. How my society organizes might be very different from how a society in Germany organizes. But the problem is how, at sort of maybe the national or global level, things have worked in the past is what has worked for one region is supposed to apply to the rest of the world. And this creates a tension where we do not learn from other ways and other societies about alternative ways to do things. And it takes such a long time before, for example, you should put that maybe in a region in Latin America, it is going to indigenous communities and speaking with the elders there, and they hold so much power and they become nodes of information and so on and so forth. So there's those little missing links. And I always say it all goes back to politics, because we are political animals at the end of the day. That's why it's us running the world and not, I don't know, elephants. But, you know, going back to understanding. So our diagnosis of where the pain points are is very important. And we need to be very creative about understanding what has worked so far, but more importantly, what hasn't, so we can start reconfiguring it. And it's really coming to a table, if you will, a global or communal table where all actors, as many actors are brought to the table as possible, but leaving room to understand who have we not brought along and making sure that we keep improving upon that. And keeping that humility to say we don't always know everything. The problem with tech specifically is it makes people feel like they're the experts, right? And we call everybody experts. I'm very hesitant to use the term expert. Yeah. I find it fascinating. I think it's a very interesting, I don't know if it's because in German, the word expert means something else. I always love learning about how Germanic words are formed. But the use of that language makes it seem like there's some people who know more than others. When if all of us are being affected, surely then aren't we all experts? So experts is people. Mm-hmm. So people is all of us. Let's go back to the basics.
Yeah. Speaking of bringing people to the same table, You have just joined the Bergedorf Roundtable lately, and speaking about the same topic that we spoke so far, so a couple of questions were asked there as well. How did it feel for you to be joining the Bergedorf Roundtable?
First of all, I think at some point into the conversations, like, how did I end up here? I mean, not in a, oh my gosh, geez, I'm so, well, yeah, everybody's honored to be there. But in terms of representation, right, it showed that there's still a long way to go in any kinds of conversation, public facing or otherwise, around making sure if we're talking about things that have a planetary scale impact, you have a representation of planetary scale. So obviously, maybe based on how it's worked in the past history, there was an overrepresentation of some communities or some groups than others.
Right.
So for me personally, when I see those kinds of things, there's a fervor that checks in. I'm like, I understand the enormous responsibility that is to step and open and keep that door ajar. To make sure other folks are represented. And so it was one of those situations where you feel like, you know, it's in terms of diversity, it's and diversity in terms of regional representation, in terms of gender representation, in terms of age representation. And, you know, you sometimes feel like you're playing diversity bingo, so you hold fort for so many. In that regard, it was very important to do that. And I think based on bringing that point up, that will necessarily help improve the kind of representation that the Bergedorf Roundtable brings going forward, because the world has changed from when it started all those years ago to have these roundtables. The world is more global, and by that we mean that there's a lot more actors who need to be at the table before we say we're having a global conversation. And that's a very important thing to keep in mind, and it was a huge takeaway. And I think bringing it up helped others understand that as well. I mean, you always know somebody in another region. So why don't we bring them along and see if we can make the table more global going forward?
100%. I think we all know that there's a long way to go. I mean, one thing that I will probably always remember is a panel discussion that we had at Körber Stiftung, which was with the Albright Foundation. Mm-hmm. It was said that there is some sort of similarity between leaders in Germany. So whoever will lead one of the biggest companies in Germany or in Europe even will have some sort of the same qualities and features, which is being graduated from a university, being white, being in the same age group. And this is so remarkable, their names will be Peter or Michael. We all were laughing at it and we all were thinking, oh my gosh, I know a couple of people actually caught like this being in very high ranks. So that is something that clearly made me think. And you're totally right. We have a long way to go. And it's great to have people like you at the table. And in 60 years, because this year we have the 60th anniversary of a Bergedorf Roundtable, there has changed a lot. I mean, as you were saying at the beginning, there wasn't even one woman. We are happy to have you around. But what would you think do we need to change for Bergedorf Roundtable, but also for other initiatives to make these groups of people more colorful and more diverse?
Question every assumption, right? So even in just curating an invite list, what are you going for and what are you going to likely miss out? Because I think there's an honesty that needs to be brought into. We're not saying everybody will get it at the next attempt to be as diverse at every possible level as possible. And I've seen initiatives that have tried to make sure that they tick the box on every diversity measure. But when you get into the room, there's a power dynamic still at the end of the day. Who gets to speak? Who feels it's a divine right? How is that all of that moderated? But it's really understanding, okay, what's the mission? What's the idea about why you're convening like this? What's the role of a convener in a global world? It has to shed assumption about if you have US and European representatives that consists global. At this point, we just need to start calling them transatlantic, right? Because the world is more visible in that regard. And just being honest about where we know the buck stops in terms of the scope or in terms of interests, really, because everybody's serving an interest. What I particularly have a gripe with is this notion of what constitutes global. And I've even experienced it a lot personally around the idea that, you know, if you're from a certain region or, you know, people decide to identify with a particular identity formation, you cannot be a contributor to a global conversation. You bring an X perspective. So the one I hear the most, for example, is tell us the African perspective. I'm like, it's 54 countries. It's not like you buy one and get 53 free. You know, you can't, you cannot think about it that way. And it's unfair for regions that are so diverse, like what is called the global South, to be brought in that way. We do not yet have that homogeneity that may seem to translate even imperfectly, really, especially in Europe, and not so much in America either, to be honest. We've all seen it. It's been laid bare with the politics of things. So just going back to those points and just being honest about the scope of what you're able to reach in terms of networks, if they still seem to be more skewed to one region or one set of perspectives, more Peters and Michaels than Nigerias and Adaranas, for example. Absolutely. But then call it and be honest about it, but keep working towards improving it and making sure that you're showing you're working around how you're trying to make it truly representative, especially if you're going for representation at a global level. The world has changed from 60 years when the US and Europe were what constituted the global order. And now we have to make sure that the tools that we've learned around convening from all those years ago, as we're bringing them forward to the new era, the eras that are coming, that are emergent, we adapt them accordingly. Not everything has to be broken down and started from scratch. We can really reform, but the reforming requires quite the political will. A lot of people stepping back from the power that they feel is their right to have by default.
You've just made a very good point on perspectives. For me as a psychologist, it's obviously all about values, about being curious, being open and approaching people with this curiosity. I can well understand that some people who have, you know, just their bubble perspective would say, what is the African perspective? And then you go back to them and tell them that there isn't this one perspective, just like there isn't this one German perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got a lot of different regions. We talk different as well. And we wouldn't say we're one another.
Right.
And if you could go back to those people asking that, if they're from Germany or from wherever they are, there is always differences within people. Not two people are the same.
Yeah.
So I would ideally say, let's enter the room and be curious, be open and see where it goes. And we will ask probably the wrong questions, like the perspective of the whole of Africa. But that's okay, as long as we get the hint and get out of the bubble and then ask another question. Mm-hmm. This curiosity and this openness, do you think it's already there, or is that something that we can do? Because you were talking about, you know, there are still power structures, there are still people in the power room that lead. How can we break this? How can we let them be more open?
Yeah, you're right. It's about curiosity and humility. But I think the hardest part is ceding power, isn't it? If you've been encultured in a society or in a worldview that tells you that you have an almost divine right to step up or stand on this pedestal and look around, and then you're the one bringing people in, it can be very difficult to then suddenly be jolted out of that and say, this power has to be redistributed. And this is a huge challenge in the world today, isn't it? I think there's efforts in fits and starts. We see it, but I think the challenge is often people trying to bring structures to very fluid issues. So we see, like with diversity, equity, and inclusion as a topic. Now we have industries around advising people on that, but these are not technical matters, and there's no one size fits all approach. The world is, we have to design interventions that are just as brilliantly chaotic as the world is, so that there's a representation really of what is happening across the board. And it's a challenging issue because, you know, people have ordered the world around structures, institutions, and so on and so forth. But we're living in such an imagined era where we have to step away from thinking that the ways of institutionalizing things or, and I also really do question why institutionalizing means rigidity. So you find that it's 8-to-5 or you name it, structures that we put in place. But the world is calling for us to step away from that. It may have worked for a while, but I think it led to a lot more exclusions. So now we have to embody that edge of chaos at which we are and recreate adaptive, resilient, context-appropriate approaches to what we're trying to do. And it's brilliantly chaotic, and that's the fun part, I think.
Nandira, I thank you for being a pioneer. I thank you for coming into these rooms and bringing in your energy, your willingness to change the world. And I think you do. And the beautiful smile that you have already does. It makes a difference, and it made a difference to me to have you on the show today. Thank you very much, Nandira Sambuli.